And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
DirecTV gives you access to apps like Netflix and live sports right next to each other.
I don't get it.
Let me put it in pigeon terms. It's like that one amazing dumpster with the old fruits and cardboard all in one place.
How am I supposed to keep up with illustrative metaphors when you are making me so hungry?
Get live TV and streaming apps together without a satellite. Visit DirecTV.com. Requires high-speed internet-connected Gemini device and separate paid subscription to watch Netflix on DirecTV. Terms and restrictions apply.
The Athletic.
Hello, I'm Mark Chapman. Welcome to the Athletic Football Podcast. Coming up a little later in the pod, our Norwich City writer Michael Bailey will join us to discuss Daniel Farke's future after Norwich's dismal display at Chelsea on Saturday. But speaking of dismal displays, first up it has to be Manchester United after their 5-0 thrashing at the hands of Liverpool at Old Trafford. I'm joined from The Athletic by Adam Crafton, Ollie Kay, and our United writer Laurie Whitwell, who was at the game for us yesterday. I'll start with you, Adam, because your piece after the game, straight after the game on Sunday, suggested that that should be the end for Ole Gunnar Solskjaer.
Yeah, it wasn't something that was planned before the game. It was obviously, you know, quite reactive to what we were seeing on the pitch. But at this point, I can't understand why Manchester United would keep Solskjaer any longer, because there's no evidence that he's continuing to either keep United at a steady level or make them better. At this point, they're only getting worse, and quite dramatically so. The result against Liverpool was probably a one-off in terms of the actual result, but in terms of the performance, that could have happened really at any point over the last few weeks. 2-0 down against Atalanta, against what was a really poor Atalanta team, I thought, as well on the night. 4-2 against Leicester. But also those home games against Villarreal, Everton, Aston Villa, games away at Wolves and Southampton where United were really poor, really open, easy to play against. And, you know, as we've said for several weeks, if they could transfer that level of performance to when they play against teams that are really good at football, then it's going to lead to huge problems. And that's what we saw yesterday. And unfortunately for Solskjaer, he is, you know, I do genuinely think he's done well for 2 years in terms of, you know, recovering United, both in terms of what they've done in the transfer market and also improved league positions. But there's absolutely no evidence now that, you know, United will be in a better place for having Solskjaer as their manager.
I wonder whether that last point, Ollie, is maybe what a lot of maybe older United fans who remember Solskjaer as a player, match-going Manchester United fans will be thinking, which is possible to think, club legend, decent guy, has made a difference to the football club after the sometimes poisonous regime of Jose Mourinho, has changed the atmosphere and the climate and so on and so forth. But sometimes you hit a limit.
Yes, definitely. The job that Solskjaer did when he came in was an important one, a sort of cleansing operation, a sort of unifying operation, steadied the ship, got, you know, improved results in the short term. I was surprised personally. Well, I wasn't surprised because I think it was just so much excitement and momentum behind him and belief in him at the time. But I don't think, and I never did think, it was the right decision to appoint him on a full-time basis. I think a more ruthless, more football savvy club would probably have turned that into a really short term appointment, whether it's 6 months or maybe 18 months or maybe 2.5 years. I was surprised that they gave him a new contract in the summer, because I felt like they'd hit their upper limit. It feels to me like something that would ideally have been an appointment where he improves it, steadies it, and then you bring in a top class coach who can elevate it to the next level. I don't think the board of football are aware enough to think in those terms. I think they've been convinced that they're on the right track and Solskjaer is the right man. And I don't think that's good enough.
So this question comes to you then, Laurie. Are they a football savvy club?
I think there's very little evidence to suggest that, right? I mean, a lot of their decisions are reactive. A lot of the signings that they make seem to be because other teams might be making them first. You look at the way that they've gone about their managerial appointments, that they can be blinded by, you know, certain influences, by certain advice. Ed Woodward, that wasn't his sort of position before he became chief executive. He wasn't football savvy, so you know, fine, he's perhaps learnt bits of it since that point, but that's not natural to him. Richard Arnold, who we expect to take over from Ed Woodward, and you've got this kind of vacuum of who actually makes that decision with Ed Woodward leaving and Richard Arnold, you know, coming in. His background is in commercial. Rugby was probably his favourite sport growing up, so it's not like it's something that's sort of, you know, inherent within him, which again, you know, it's not a, you know, a stick to beat anyone with particularly, but equally when it comes to these crunch decisions on football where you need some proactivity, where you need a kind of forward-thinking decision-making process, yeah, I think it's in short supply at Manchester United.
You spoke to Ole Gunnar Solskjaer after the game.
Yeah, it was a pretty brutal press conference, to be fair, because he'd done his broadcast duties and it took him quite a while, obviously, and then it was probably about an hour after full-time whistle when he came in to see us. It was a bit more of a delay than usual. I got the first question to ask, and usually the first question that a manager gets in a press conference after a game is kind of a bit of a dolly, you know, a sort of soft, you know, where did it go right, where did it go wrong.
Did you bowl him a bouncer here?
Yeah, there was only one story in town, so I just sort of asked him. After that kind of performance, you know, with it not being an isolated incident, you know, the Leicester game was fresh in our minds, the chaos of that game defensively, the fact that you've got players getting booked and sent off, you know, Ronaldo could have been sent off, you know, not only Paul Pogba. So you had this kind of approach from players that sort of looked like they'd lost their minds, and that is never a good sign for a manager. How do you actually bring this back? How can you bring this back as a manager? And to be fair to him, he answered the question, you know, politely. You know, he would probably have been within his rights to sort of, you know, shout down my throat, but he actually answered it in a mature way in terms of saying, you know, I'll come back tomorrow with positivity. How can we amend this? You know, and basically looking forward, which is the only way you can do, analyse it. But then each question subsequent to that was basically on the same theme. You know, would you consider resigning? Do you think you can still offer something to Manchester United? So it was a pretty brutal press conference for any manager to go through, I think.
You've compared him, Ollie, to Roy Evans.
Yeah, Roy Evans, time at Liverpool in the mid-90s, and I think I said in the piece there was a danger that, you know, that this seems a bit flattering to Solskjaer rather than to Roy Evans. I know Roy Evans might just be sort of disparaged as some manager who came in and failed at Liverpool, but Roy Evans came in, steadied the ship, had a really good sort of 3 years, challenged for a title, great football, restored the club's values, and was perceived to be a sort of step back to what the club needed to be and had been in the glory days. But the real parallel is that, yes, he was this sort of consensual, harmonising figure, but he wasn't then able to kick on. He wasn't able to do the next step. And the club were so convinced that he was the man to do it because he'd had a good first 2 years that they gave him probably more time when a more ruthless approach, less sentimental approach, would have been to upgrade at some point and build on the good work he's done, because the final year or so or more of Roy Evans was, I think, treading water or going backwards. And I think if they'd made the decision not to give him a new contract in the summer and moved him on and said, look, thank you, you've done a brilliant job, or even given him another role and replaced him with a better coach, I think that would have been a far better decision.
Adam Laurie, you go first, Adam. Do you get any sense that he might be a shield in all of this? And we've heard it before with other managers. You could argue that Steve Bruce was most definitely a shield for Mike Ashley at Newcastle. All the attention is on the manager. It's not as much on the players, and it's most definitely not on the chief executive and the boardroom at the moment.
I think that's maybe is the way that it's playing out. I don't think that's the intent. I think they're genuinely believed. They came to believe that he could restore the club to where they were. I think they fully bought into that, you know, I mean, because why else would you do what you did in the summer in terms of giving him, you know, 130 million plus God knows what in wages to sign the players that they did. I think they were sincere in believing that Solskjaer is the right man for United, whether they still do, you know, let's see this week. But no, I don't think there's a kind of an ulterior motive there. In terms of Solskjaer being at the club at all. Is that something you think, Laurie?
I mean, I suppose when you look at what the Glazers own the club for, it is to make money. It's, you know, that's the whole purpose of the 2005, you know, takeover. That's why they have dividends. That's why they're selling their shares by the hundreds of millions of dollars recently. You know, that's why they tried to do the Super League. So if you have a manager in place who is actually the fans adore, basically, because of what he's done as a player, then that makes it more difficult for fans to kind of get very angry in the stadium, you know. I mean, that was the first time I've heard boos at Old Trafford at halftime against Atalanta, and it quickly turned with the singing section into a kind of rallying call that actually worked. But then obviously yesterday that the boos were more pronounced, but I think if they had a manager in place, perhaps I suppose Jose was actually, you know, liked by the match going fans, but if perhaps there wasn't that kind of affinity with the manager, then maybe it would be trained on the owners quickly, more quickly.
It's funny though what you say about sort of having the best in class people, because or someone that's learning on the job, which essentially Solskjaer has been doing in terms of being a top level coach. They have so many people at that club who have been allowed to learn on the job over the past decade, whether it's Woodward moving into the football side of things despite having no experience of it, whether it's Matt Judge becoming the negotiator despite not having previous football negotiating experience, whether it's Kieran McKenna, who was a youth coach, and then all of a sudden he was Manchester United's first team coach, whether it's, you know, Michael Carrick moving in to become a coach as well. You know, these are all people that were learning on the job at the most demanding environment in the world, or at least it should be. And now, you know, Richard Arnold's about to have certainly more say, it appears, over the football side of the club. And we know that he's not got very much experience in terms of dealing with agents or making decisions over managers. That is the story of Manchester United over the past decade. You know, at so many parts of the club, you're asking, have they got the best fit and the most qualified person for that job? And the answer is almost invariably no.
I think they generally tend to make sure that the people they have in the commercial department are experienced and are good at their job. And I don't think they stand for sort of sustained underperformance in the commercial department. But commercial department ends up reflecting what you do on the pitch, not the other way around. They have ended up flatlining as a commercial force because they've not ended up getting huge amounts of money from sponsorship deals which were linked to success, and the brand hasn't really grown because the football club has stagnated, I'd say, for several years.
Ollie's problem now, Laurie, is that this is his team and his players, and the players that have come in are his players. You would have to believe that. And therefore, there have to be greater questions around him, because you would say, well, hang on a minute, you just picked the same starting 11 that made a right mess of it at home to Atalanta in the first 45 minutes on Wednesday for this Liverpool game. And you've got players on the bench that apparently you spent 2 years chasing, trying to sign, and they're not even in the team. You know, the questions now, quite rightly, can be on Solskjaer's tactics and transfers.
Yeah, absolutely. Before now, you could always, I mean, you look back to that team in 2019-2020 when you got Andreas Pereira as the starting number 10, and you're thinking, okay, that's obviously going to hamper a Manchester United manager. The options on the bench just weren't there. The amount of times they went behind in games and just drifted to 1-0 defeats, you know, it was embarrassing for a club of United stature. And so therefore you had this idea that, okay, with Solskjaer he could identify the broader issues at the club and could improve that situation. Now, yeah, he has got a large amount of players that are his picks in the team, in the squad. You could probably argue over a couple. I mean, Donny van de Beek, you know, we'll go back to as perhaps one of the players that was available at the time, and did he absolutely want, but that's perhaps a moot point because, yeah, as you say, ultimately, Jadon Sancho is in the squad now, Cristiano Ronaldo, Rafael Varane. I know obviously he's been injured for the last couple of games, and I suppose maybe that exposes, you know, the job that he was doing if United have fragmented so quickly in his absence. But yeah, I think this is why people are now justifiably scrutinising Solskjaer's position, because it's 3 years in, so not only is the kind of idea of your team supposed to be instilled properly, but also the players that you've got are your players, and you're able to kind of instruct them to the fullest degree, without, you know, perhaps getting back chat or without players being there that you don't want there, that he, you know, he's obviously mentioned when he first took over certain players that weren't up to standards in that regard. And it seems to be getting worse, you know. I mean, the way that defence is all over the place against Leicester, you know, obviously at Atalanta, but yesterday at the back four, I mean, that back four is the back four that, you know, was starting last season, you know, and actually doing quite well. So what's happened for them to kind of lose all cohesion?
Laurie, it's not just the back four, it's the back ten. That was his team, yeah, for most of last season. Greenwood, Fernandes, Rashford, McTominay, Fred, De Gea, okay, was a bit more in and out. These are the players that he trusts. These are the ones that are meant to have his back. The ones on the bench are the ones that he maybe has doubts about, whether that's, you know, Van de Beek or Lingard or Sancho or whatever. You know, this was his fallback Where do you go from here? Because McTominay and Fred, I actually didn't think they were the real problem yesterday. I think the whole setup was the problem. But when the ones that you trust aren't doing it for you, then you've got a massive, massive problem. And there's all such weird decisions that they make. Why did they give Eric Bailly a new contract? Right? They gave him a new contract earlier this year. Harry Maguire clearly, you know, wasn't fit, didn't look fully fit for that game at Leicester last week. But, you know, the possibility of playing playing Bailly was so terrifying for Solskjaer that he was prepared to play a half-fit Maguire. Meanwhile, you've got Bailly on a contract for a few more years. I'm getting worked up, but it's absolutely... It's ridiculous.
Listen, you're quite often in a whole variety of sports. You're a better player when you're not in the team, if a team is struggling. But if you are Bailly, Dalot, Van der Beek, Lingard, just to think of four, then you go, well, hang on, how on earth are we not even being given an opportunity? That and Lingard probably said something along those lines to a fan yesterday. It seems that by having Solskjaer's trust, you become in some ways almost untouchable. You know, that for this massive squad, to all intents and purposes, there isn't really massive competition for places because half of them don't appear to be trusted, Laurie.
Yeah, it's a great point. The Lingard thing is one that has baffled me this season. The fact that he's produced every time he's played pretty much when he's come off the bench and to not get a chance. I think it perhaps stems back to the fact that Cristiano Ronaldo, you know, he tried to rotate him out of the team against Everton and got pulled up by Fergie straight away, which is, I suppose, unfortunate. But equally, it seems that Ronaldo is, you know, undroppable, even coming off in a game. You know, he came off against Young Boys when they were down to 10 men and that was scrutinised. So all these... And you think perhaps a manager who has established pedigree, who's won things in the past, wouldn't have any qualms with that, you know, would embrace, you know, whatever scrutiny came his way. Whereas with Solskjaer, it's understandable if he feels perhaps a little bit less secure in that kind of dynamic, and the players therefore will also be slightly questioning that dynamic. But yeah, I think the Ronaldo thing is an interesting thing.
Can't have anybody that's untouchable, can you, Ollie? I mean, Mane was left out yesterday. Matip was, who's you could argue has been Liverpool's best centre half this season, actually. He was left out yesterday. There's nobody really that's untouchable within that Liverpool side. I mean, there are plenty of other positive comparisons for Liverpool compared to Manchester United, but that's a big one.
Klopp generally hasn't been a massive rotator of his squad over the time he's been at Liverpool. Not to this way that Guardiola has at Manchester City, but I would say that the difference at Liverpool at the moment, and it wasn't the case midway through last season, is they've got 17, 18, 19 players playing really well. So it doesn't really matter who you play. Whereas Manchester United started the season with maybe five or six playing well. They've probably got nobody playing well now. And it doesn't matter who you play. For Harry Maguire to have come in as what was it, £80 million and made captain very quickly, you would have imagined that would have taken a really, really high impact, Van Dijk type impact. And it hasn't. It's almost by default, he's become the sort of rock-like figure around which they build their defence. And he's not a rock. He's a good defender. I think he was excellent for England in the Euros. The times I've been most impressed with him have been playing for England. And I don't know what that says about the coaching setup or the personnel at Manchester United. But all these players, like, you know, like Fred becoming the sort of go-to man, despite never really, really doing it for Manchester United. McTominay being a go-to man and a sort of untouchable, despite, you know, being a sort of willing and reasonably talented, but not elite level. The team is full of this. And this is why when people say, oh, well, you know, he's restored the culture, he's restored this, he's restored a sort of sense of, you know, Man United values. I don't think he has at all. He's stabilised the club, but it doesn't look like a setup which has any sense of real intensity, self-governance,
lack of ruthlessness
leadership. That is what comes across. And I think if you put Manchester United's players in, you know, under a different manager and put Solskjaer in charge of, say, Liverpool's squad or Manchester City's squad, United have good players. Not absolutely everywhere, but they have good players. The idea that Solskjaer has restored that attitude is a myth, really.
You're definitely right about the ruthlessness. He was ruthless when he put in that first summer in terms of, you know, looking at the decision to get rid of Romelu Lukaku, which, you know, I don't really know how that's aged, really, given, you know, what he's done since. But I think most people who were watching him in his final season felt it was the right thing to do at the time. The patience he's shown with players, particularly like Martial, Pogba, Maguire at times, De Gea, you know, okay, he's had a good start to this season, but how many mistakes did he have to make before he was dropped and Dean Henderson was given a run last season? And you can say with sort of players like De Gea and Maguire and Shaw that they've got better at times under Solskjaer and they've recovered from bad runs of form, but he never really looked likely to drop them at the moments where he needed to probably make that point. And the Pogba situation just kind of encapsulates all of it. You've got this player who they're offering to make, you know, probably behind Ronaldo as higher paid player at the club. And on what evidence? On what evidence over the past 5.5 years could you sit down and say, here's all the things that he's passed in terms of key performance indicators to justify that status? And then if they do that, they'll go round another cycle where Bruno Fernandes expects that and Marcus Rashford expects that. And you just go round and round and round and round and round. It is that lack of ruthlessness that Pogba, they had a decision to make. It could have been last summer. It could have been this summer. I think the fact they bought Donny van der Beek suggests that they maybe thought a decision was coming on Paul Pogba. But instead, they've just let it play out because they get, once every 6 weeks or so, they get this fantastic performance. And it kind of deludes them into thinking, oh, we could get that every week still. There's still that player we can unlock in there, whether we get that extra signing here or we move that player there. And then it doesn't happen. And now they're in a situation where they've got an asset who, you know, whatever United fans might think of him, is considered one of the best players in Europe by a lot of different clubs, that they're probably going to lose for nothing. Because why on earth would he sign a contract at the moment to stay at United? It's just another encapsulation of really poor decision-making across all levels of the club there.
That's the mitigation for Solskjaer. And you mentioned about the Lukaku thing. I mean, he did drop Pogba last season when everyone was thinking he doesn't have the balls to do it. And actually he did. And obviously he's put him on the bench for these last two games. But ultimately he's part of a structure at United where it is quite safe. It's quite a compliant structure that they've got there because ultimately the Glazers want control. So they put a guy as the chief exec who is trusted, you know, in terms of the banking world, and they've got them the takeover, and now the successor is going to be someone who is known from PricewaterhouseCoopers since 1993 and has worked with the Glazers. So there's this kind of, you know, umbrella of kind of compliance throughout the club that therefore when you get these situations where maybe a manager wants to get rid of a player, I believe that Solskjaer would have sold Anthony Martial, you know, given the chance. But you've got this sort of conflicting factor where above them, they think actually maybe he is a player that we can develop and we can still, you know, get good value from. And also, do they have the wherewithal to actually sell these kind of players, to be dynamic in the transfer market in that regard? I know it's easier said than done, but I kind of feel that whoever is in charge of Manchester United will have difficulties in this regard.
The Glazers, I think that, you know, the perception is that they're spendthrift and they're trying to cut corners and all that kind of thing. Actually, the story of the past few years has been excess and waste.
Kieran Maguire put this on social media, Price of Football account. They've spent, in the last decade, they spent £310 million more on wages and £600 million more net on transfers than Liverpool.
Was it last week or the week before where we went through, look at all those different options in forward positions for Man United that they have? Cavani, Ronaldo, Rashford, Sancho, Greenwood, Fernandes, Pogba, Juan Mata's still at the club. Why? I mean, as a person, love him to pieces, but for everyone's sake, why is he still there? What purpose is he serving for the club? And, you know, look at the situation they created with Lingard, where they, having depreciated his value as an asset over several years because, you know, they'd been unable to get performances out of him, they then managed to restore his value by getting him a good loan move and then managed to blow it up by not selling him at the right time in the summer. The manager says, oh, he's got an important part to play. Then he can't get in the team. Now his contract's running down and they might lose him for nothing. There's so many sort of scenarios which show mismanagement. The thing that I don't think we should distract from is United have a good squad of players, and United have a squad of players that I think is at least capable of finishing fourth in the league. I think it would be capable under the right coach of finishing not miles off the top three in terms of points, and Solskjaer is failing in that regard. So for all the mismanagement above him, I think it's absolutely fair to say someone else could be doing a lot better.
Liverpool were quite good, weren't they, Ollie?
They were, and they've been brilliant for all but about 45 minutes of this season. They've played at such a high level, but I don't think yesterday was off the scale in terms of performance. It was very impressive the way they played through them, but it was like watching them against Watford the previous week. And my view when I watched them against Watford was, God, this team looks terrible. This team looked like they haven't been on the training ground all week, and that's exactly how it was with Man United on Sunday. It was so easy, and you got people like, you know, Firmino just going where he liked, playing where he liked, nobody anywhere near him, nobody knowing what to do with Salah. That first goal after, what was it, 4 minutes, and you've got Salah turning, and there's three players, Robertson, Trent Alexander-Arnold and Keita, all sort of running on ahead of him. All would have been through on goal if Salah wanted to pass to them. It was utterly inept from United, and I do think there's a danger that how well Liverpool played could get lost in the clamour of yet another Manchester United inquest. But honestly, I do think, you know, when that people pundits do that thing, a bit of both, really. I think the amount to which that was down to Manchester United's ineptitude was awful. It was staggering how poor they were. Liverpool and played really well, but didn't need to be absolutely off the scale in order to score five times in the first 50 minutes. And that's, you know, what does that say? And as Adam said at the start, Villarreal could have done that a few weeks ago in terms of the number of chances they created. Everton created chances, Atalanta created chances. They just look really, really easy to play against.
Laurie, I imagine most people listening will be wondering, you know, is anything likely to happen with the manager imminently? Have United been suggesting anything at all since the game? Has anything palpably changed?
Don't know is the honest answer at the moment. That could obviously change. I mean, after the Leicester game, it was fairly swift that it was, you know, this wasn't going to be pivotal for Solskjaer. The faith was still there. Yet to get those kind of statements, I suppose, privately from the relevant people. So maybe you could read into that. But equally, I'd be very hesitant to shift 180 degrees, you know, in the space of a week, whatever the catastrophe that was Old Trafford yesterday. I mean, and touching on what Ollie said there, I mean, United did look like a relegation team, didn't they? Like in that match, like it was that kind of disparate, all players doing their own thing, you know, sort of style to it, where you're sort of just thinking this is fragmenting dramatically, and that might, you know, play a part in the decision-making process. You know, arresting that feels like it's going to be a huge task. We've been here before with Solskjaer in terms of the scrutiny and the questions, but it's usually
nothing like this.
Yeah, nothing like this. Yeah, it's been averted before this point. The Leicester game was the usual turning point in that kind of Solskjaer narrative. So for that fact that it went the other way, and has been compounded by the Liverpool result and performance. You know, however good Liverpool were, as Ollie says, they were good, yeah, but they, you know, we've seen them probably better. So it's not like they were up against this unbelievable force that anybody would have succumbed to. So that's the real concern, and that's what will be. They'll have to have those kind of conversations at United this week.
Calls to make, Laurie.
Indeed.
There you go.
hammering the phone.
See you soon.
See you later. Thanks for having me on.
Cheers, Ollie.
Thanks very much.
Victorinox, the makers of the original Swiss Army knife, have been a reliable companion for life's everyday challenges, mastering functionality, innovation, iconic design, and uncompromising quality with its products. The Victorinox Swiss Army knife provides you with all the things you don't think about until you need it: tweezers, a screwdriver, and even a corkscrew. With the Victorinox Swiss Army Knife, you can be prepared to master everyday life. You can find Victorinox Swiss Army Knives at Dick's Sporting Goods.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer, if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Well, if you thought the first half of the pod was miserable, I don't think it's going to get any better, really, because we're going to move from Manchester United on to Norwich. Michael Bailey covers the club for The Athletic. Thrashed at Chelsea at the weekend, they remain winless and rooted to the bottom of the Premier League. Even from when we last spoke, it's probably gone downhill.
Yes, I would say it's gone downhill, and it's been incredibly disappointing. And probably Norwich are at a point where I didn't think they would get to, which is a degree of some serious questions really being asked over the whole project that they took into the Premier League for a second time in 3 years. I think it's been incredibly disappointing how it's played out so far.
Who are the questions being asked of the most?
The most, I think, is straightforward. I think there is now a proper conversation about Daniel Farke's future, certainly amongst the fans. And that's predominantly on the basis as to whether he can operate at Premier League level, I would say. There are some question marks being asked of the recruitment now, which I think is understandable because although Norwich produced a lot of it in the summer, fans always get excited because they're new players. It takes you a month or two to realise whether they're going to cut it or not. And there are some quite big question marks over that. So Stuart Webber, the sporting director, is getting a bit of a few questions directed at him. And I guess in general, whether what Norwich have tried to achieve at this level is realistically possible.
Here's one thing on the project then, before we get on to Daniel Farke. I know Adam's tweeted about Daniel Farke, so we'll bring him in shortly. But this has always been a project that has appeared incredibly connected between Webber, the board, Farke, everybody pulling in the same direction. Billy Gilmore obviously didn't play on Saturday because of the loan rules. But to an outsider, he maybe symbolises a disconnect between Webber and Farke in the fact that this bright young talent is brought in. He had a good Euros for Scotland. Everybody's raving about him. He's brought in and yet hasn't really been used. So, and as I say, this is just coming from an outsider's perspective who doesn't see Norwich 90 minutes week in, week out. Is that fair?
Billy Gilmore is a really interesting case, but I think the reasoning is probably unfair because Billy Gilmore is here because Stuart Webber brought him in, but also Daniel Farke loves him as a player. So the fact that Billy Gilmore hasn't been playing, I think it's because he played his first few games as Norwich's sole defensive midfielder and, to be honest, couldn't cope with it physically. He couldn't snuff out the danger, which, to be fair, is probably understandable for where Norwich are. And since then, Daniel has been struggling to find a team that can keep teams and the opposition out, but also that creates chances. And I think Billy Gilmore then hasn't featured in that framework because there are probably more experienced and more physically capable players that are playing ahead of him. That would be the argument. I'm not saying whether I agree with that or not. So I don't think it's a disconnect there. And it's going to be interesting now what happens, because ultimately, if Stuart Webber is going to make a call over the manager over the coming games, because it's still not working, that will be the first time he's had to do something like that as in his role at either Huddersfield or Norwich. And that would be a symbol of having to do something different and the point at which he has to acknowledge that it's not working at Premier League level.
Adam?
I'm sort of coming at it from an outsider's point of view, but I mean, the statistics are appalling in the Premier League. There is just no data really whatsoever to support Daniel Farke as a Premier League manager, unfortunately. And that doesn't mean that he's a bad manager. It means he is maybe suited to coaching a team that's at the top end of a league, coaching a team that is generally, you know, where the quality of players is quite high relative to opponents, which is why he's clearly had success in the championship with the style of play that he has. I think that more sort of defensive setup clearly isn't a natural fit for him in terms of trying to strike that balance. I think he wants to be, you know, asserting his personality on the team, and that's why they were so great, I think, in the championship. I think it kind of comes down to what do Norwich want as a club. If Norwich want to be fighting to stay in the Premier League this season, you know, there's obvious grounds that a change should be made. If Norwich are content, and I don't say this as a dig or a criticism, but if Norwich are content to go down again and to try and rebuild again, and they, you know, there's no one better than Daniel Farke to take them back up. So, but I do think at the same time, keeping him is almost an acceptance of what's going to come. But maybe it's, okay, it's 9 games. It's almost, you start to look at it and think, is it actually already too far gone for anyone now to come in and keep them up in terms of the morale of the group of players and where they are in the table?
No, I saw your tweet. I saw your tweet over the weekend, Adam. And
banned from East Anglia.
Indeed. And it's certainly been in the back of my mind, what do they do here? Because what is prioritising either being in the Premier League or keeping Daniel Farke as head coach, probably. I mean, they're at home to Leeds on Saturday. I wouldn't ever see Norwich making a decision off the back of losing at Chelsea like that. But, you know, that Leeds game and then at Brentford the following week, in my mind, decisive games for them to make that decision. No one's going to say it, but I get the idea from the club that this time is different and that, you know, they are not willing to just completely sacrifice this season for the sake of keeping Daniel Farke in the as a championship coach if it all plays out. And actually, I think Norwich, if it does play out like this and Norwich do end up back in the championship, they have got a far tougher scenario to deal with than they did the previous season. They've got a completely different set of players that were brought in to deal with the Premier League. It's not like everyone's going to be willing to dig in and try and get them out of it and as part of a longer-term learning process. So ultimately, it feels like this is a kind of a tipping point where, you know, Norwich have to make the most of this opportunity right now and not worry about what next season could possibly look like.
Obviously, there's been pressure on Farke, but also they did spend reasonably in the summer, didn't they? And they brought in the money for Buendia. Have any of those signings looked really like improving the team or not yet?
Well, I've had this debate with people as to whether this squad is better than the one 2 years ago. And I think probably on paper, which is obviously a great place to play football, you know, there's a greater pedigree in these players. But at the moment, what they're actually delivering is inferior. And you look at Josh Sargent and Milot Rashica, who came in from Werder Bremen, who had two really difficult years and eventually got relegated. They look like players who have played in a relegated team and in another one, to be honest. And these, you know, that's 20 million quid's worth of talent right there. And whilst I appreciate in the circumstances Norwich felt they had to cash in on Emi Buendia, looking at it now, that has taken a massive chunk out of what Norwich were trying to do in terms of scoring goals. And I can't figure out what the plan is for them to try and score goals now. And that's why they've only scored one from open play in their first 9 games.
Does the noise around Norwich increase because of how the other two promoted clubs are doing, in the sense that you could say that Brentford are a bit more like Norwich in that they have a project and they plan and they do things a certain way? I mean, God knows what you could say about Watford. I mean, you know, I'm not sure Watford are a project, but they're good fun to watch and cover and talk about. And yet there are more positive signs. I mean, you couldn't imagine Norwich going to Goodison and scoring 5, could you? However much of a freak result that may have been. So I wonder whether what the other two promoted clubs are doing doesn't necessarily help the noise around Norwich.
Yeah, I mean, with Watford, I would never criticise how they do it because it does genuinely seem to work for them. Some fair play to them. A lot of the caveats first time around were that, you know, it was Norwich's first go. They hadn't got it right. So second time around, they'd be better because they'd learned all these lessons. So 100% for Brentford to be doing what they're doing, for Thomas Frank to have got such a good balance out of them, regardless of the caveats of tough starts and difficult pre-seasons, it puts Norwich to shame. And to be honest, I was conscious of that the moment Brentford got promoted in the playoff final, that was going to be a huge yardstick for where Norwich's development would be this year. So undoubtedly, especially for the supporters, I think, who are now looking at it and they feel embarrassed that Norwich are basically a laughing stock at the moment in terms of the football world. You know, this was supposed to be development. And if anything, they look like they've completely regressed. And, you know, Daniel Farke is trying to stick as many players behind the ball as possible so they can scrape a couple of clean sheets in games that they would probably would have had to have won. So, yeah, it ratchets up the pressure hugely in terms of what those other two clubs are doing.
The mindset and the psychology is really interesting, isn't it, Adam? I bang on about this all the time with Brentford, you know, but Brentford's mentality, what they said to their players from their sporting directors was, there is no difference between the bottom half of the Premier League and the top half of the Championship. So all those teams are equals to us. So you don't have anything to fear. Going up to the Premier League wasn't seen within Brentford as trying to finish 17. They said, you know, half these clubs are our equals. That difference in mindset and psychology at the moment, I know it's early days, is probably paying dividend.
To be brutal, I suppose, looking at the two teams' performances on the pitch, it looks like Brentford are aiming for the top half and Norwich are aiming for a good 20th. As it, you know, you sometimes hear about teams aiming for, if we come 17th, we'll be happy. With Norwich, it's almost like if we get, you know, a good points tally for 20th, then it's sort of okay. It's and I know they don't think like that inside, but that's how I felt just sort of watching the team over the last few weeks in terms of how poor it's been. I'd be a bit cautious with Brentford. Just obviously I think what they've done is fantastic, but you know, I think one of the things they have in their favour is this is their first Premier League season. Norwich have been up and down, up and down, up and down. So that idea of bounce that you get as a club and a fan base and being a novelty, a bit like, you know, we saw with Sheffield United a couple of years ago as well. I think you do get that when it's far less familiar. And I think Norwich is slightly a victim of this being a familiar thing and not a completely unique phenomenon. And obviously we saw what happened to Sheffield United the season later. We're seeing now with Leeds how much harder it is as well in the second campaign. So I think, you know, I don't think it's going to be straightforward for Brentford, you know, all the time. But certainly I think Norwich have missed that bounce and that real impact around the city that they did have, I think, last time when they came up and they beat, They pushed Chelsea, didn't they, pretty close early on. They beat Man City. There was that real, I remember being in the town for that City game, and there was a real, real buzz around the place. I'm not sure that's probably translated this time.
I think it struck some of the players in the squad this time, actually. They were like, where's the enthusiasm from the supporters at getting promoted again?
Just dread.
You have to kind of, yeah, you have to kind of say to them, well, they've done this a lot and it's generally gone really badly. And I honestly think that baggage does make it far harder for Norwich, but you have to deal with it. You can't just sort of bin it off after 9 games because it's not working either.
The final one goes back to this Leeds fixture, really, Michael, which strikes me as a horrible fixture for Norwich to have in the predicament that they're in. But then I'm not sure what would be a good fixture for them at the moment.
No, the fixture list looks dreadful at the moment. And as I said, it's Brentford after that away from home, which whatever happens in the Leeds game, if it's all still going on, then you imagine Norwich have to get a positive result from that. I think they need a positive result from both games, really, because the only caveat with the Chelsea defeat was that it was Chelsea. No one's going to talk about changes or anything like that. But for me, for sitting where I am, I just don't see how Daniel Farker survives two difficult results, and we'll see what we get on Saturday.
And sitting where you are is a Costa Coffee car park, so we'll let you go and get your coffee. Thank you.
Oh man, thank you, Mark. Thanks, Adam.
Cheers, Mike.
Cheers, Michael. Right, that's it. Thanks for listening. To read all the articles we've discussed today, head to theathletic.com/footballpod for a 33% discount off the price of an annual subscription. And I'm back on Thursday for the Business of Sport podcast.
The Athletic.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic.
See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code The Athletic and you'll get a 1-year subscription to The Athletic plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.